It's still summer in Australia. Well, in some parts of the country, it's always hot. But if you've been hankering for cold weather activities, the Winter Olympics are about to start. So while you're in your shorts and T-shirt, you can watch all sorts of wintry sports on TV. You know, the snowboarders and ice skaters and luges and so on. Some of them will no doubt jump higher or spin more or go faster than ever before, with feats that would have once been considered way beyond human capability. Does this mean that we all have a sort of untapped ability to do more than you think you can? Alex Hutchinson is a former long-distance runner and a physicist. He's been exploring what he calls the curiously elastic limits of human performance in a book called Endure. Alex Hutchinson joins us from Toronto in Canada, where I imagine, Alex, it's pretty cold right now.
Yeah, we've had enough snow that I was able to go cross-country skiing out my door earlier today.
Well, no wonder Canada always does well at the Winter Olympics. Let's talk about the capacity to endure whatever the activity is. How do you, in a nutshell, describe being able to keep going?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways of defining endurance, but the definition that I ended up really liking that I heard from a researcher was it's the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. Yeah. So that's whether you're running a marathon or whether you're doing your taxes, that captures that sense of endurance.
Right. And when you talk about endurance, as you say, you don't mean just doing ultra marathons or big expeditions. Tell me more about how you think the capacity to endure applies more broadly.
Yeah, when I started researching this topic, I came at it as a runner, and I was thinking very simply of endurance as, you know, how can I run faster or why can't I run faster and what is it that stops me? But as I started to look at what the limiting factors are, what I realized is that there's a lot of commonality between feeling you've reached your limits in the middle of a marathon and feeling you've reached your limits, in the middle of studying for an exam, that often it's the sensation of effort or the sensation that you can't go on that is most important. So I think it ends up being, the skills you learn in an endurance sport have broad, application, because we all face situations where we're struggling to continue and we have to find ways of pushing past those limits, whether they're physical or mental limits.
So as you say, the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. Now, you describe some amazing historical feats of human endurance. The explorer Ernest Shackleton, for example.
Yeah, there have been some modern scientists who've tried to reconstruct what it is that guys like Shackleton and Scott did in their Antarctic expeditions. And by some calculations, they might have burned about 1 million calories over the course of 4 months. So 6,000 to 10,000 calories a day, day after day, hauling sleds that weighed, a couple hundred kilograms. So and you sort of ask, well, is it because they were extraordinarily physically strong, or was it because they were, really in good shape and had big muscles and things like, and a powerful heart? And what you find is it's impossible to disentangle those two things. You can't do what those Antarctic explorers did without extraordinary physical capacity and the will to endure and extraordinary mental endurance. And all of those come together in those sorts of feats.
With people like, say, Ernest Shackleton, surviving in Antarctica in extreme circumstances, but also with top-level athletes, can they do what they do because, apart from, well, you talk about physical and mental abilities, but is it because also they don't feel pain as much as maybe I do?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question that researchers have been trying to untangle for a long time. And what it turns out is that if you take a bunch of really elite athletes and you compare them to just the rest of us, normal population, and you do a pain test. So, for example, you administer electric shocks that are steadily increase in severity. Athletes and non-athletes will reach their pain threshold at around the same point. They'll both say, hey, that hurts, at roughly the same point. The difference will come in how long the people are willing to tolerate further increases in pain. And the athletes are just willing to, they feel it the same as everyone else, but they're willing to endure it for longer.
Right, sort of greater tolerance.
Yeah, and so obviously there's lots of interest in trying to figure out what is that? Is it that they have some sort of brain chemicals, or are there different connections to the brain? But the current thinking is really it's mainly a result of psychological coping mechanisms that through the process of training, of being in discomfort on a daily basis, they've learned things like being able to distract themselves and also to be able to reframe discomfort as it's not a reason to panic. Your leg isn't going to fall off just because you're getting tired. It's just emotionally neutral information that helps you.
What about those stories you hear, Alex, about people who can lift a car in an emergency, a panicked mother whose child is pinned under a car? One, are they true? And two, how are they able to do it?
Yeah, there's a long history of trying to understand this, because, of course, the challenge is that all these extraordinary incidents, and they happen on a regular basis, none of them happen in a laboratory. They all happen out on a street with two people watching in not very good light. And there is some reason to think that, if I just try and lift something voluntarily as heavily as I can, I'm not getting everything out of myself. And researchers have done all sorts of amusing things to try and test this. There was one study back in the 50s where the researchers asked subjects to lift a heavy weight, and then just before they were about to lift the weight, they snuck up behind them and fired a pistol in their ear to scare the daylights out of them. And they were able to lift, 7% more, which is comparable to getting an injection of adrenaline. So there are some ways of getting a little bit more strength out of yourself.
Now, so it's having a reason.
Yeah, well, triggering that fear, fight or flight response, fear of death, or desire to win the Olympics, all of these things allow you to dig a little deeper. Now, whether you can lift an actual car is pushing it a little far, but there's no doubt that most of us, I think the limits that we perceive as physical in almost every case are actually mediated by the brain, not by the muscles.
Well, as a runner, when you were at university, you had an interesting experience when you broke your personal record in a 1500-meter race.
Yeah, I'd been... So I was trying to break 4 minutes for 1500, which is 1500 meters is a little shorter than a mile. So mm-hmm. I was not quite in the John Landy category, but I'd been stuck for about 4 years at about the same level, running 401, 402. And one day, just at a very meaningless race, the timekeeper was calling out splits that turned out to be inaccurate and misled me into thinking I was running way faster than I was without trying harder. And this was such a great feeling that I just thought, wow, this is the day of my life. And I sort of threw caution to the wind and went for it. And I ended up running 3:52, which was a massive 9-second personal best. And what was most interesting to me is that I never went back to the old level. I never again struggled to break 4 minutes. It was easy from then on. And so
that
was the moment when I... Yeah.
What do you take from that? That was where your brain was really tricked into thinking something.
Yeah, and there's a ton of research into the power of deception when it's wielded correctly. But that lesson really stuck with me as a kind of, until then I would have said, limits are all about, how much oxygen your heart can pump to your muscles. And that showed me that really your perception of your limits is more important. And it doesn't mean that it's all in your head or it's easy to change, but it suggests that if you can find it, there almost always is a reserve there.
Here in Life Matters, Alex Hutchinson is with us. He's a science journalist, a physicist, a former long-distance runner, and he's been looking into the physical or other limits of human capacity. And I wonder if there have been times in your life when you've done something you thought yourself physically incapable of, maybe in an emergency situation where you found you had some kind of strength or endurance you'd not thought possible, or sometime you managed to do a run or a swim that really pushed your limits. You can tell us about it on Facebook. We're at ABCRN Life Matters. Now, Alex, as you mentioned, the classic example in sport of a barrier being broken is the 4 minute mile. Once it was thought impossible for any person to do that until, first of all, Roger Bannister did it in 1954, and then John Landy did it, and after that, runners could do it regularly. The big one now, of course, is to break the two-hour mark for a marathon. Do you see that happening anytime soon?
Well, first I have to confess that I did a big research project for Runner's World on this about 4 years ago, and I predicted that it would happen in 2075.
Okay, so a fair way off.
Yeah, except I have to revise that now. Last year, Nike put on this big project where Eliud Kipchoge ended up running 2 hours, 0 minutes, and 25 seconds in a kind of artificial race. And that was way beyond what most of us thought was possible. So I'm going to move that forward and say, I think it's possible. I think it's probably still a couple decades away, but it's on the table now, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that race, as I understand it, I think was in, you called it an artificial race, you know, it's in particular conditions. And I suppose, you know, if we're talking particularly in sport, but in other areas too, the idea of doing better than before has to be in part technological as well as mental and physical, doesn't it?
Absolutely. But I think one of the really interesting things that I came across is that if you track the progression of world records, not just in humans, but in other animals like thoroughbred horses and dog racing, for a long time, they were sort of progressing all at the same rate. But around the 1950s, horses and dogs stopped getting faster. And so they're still benefiting from technology, but they don't have the power of the brain to be able to say, well, someone else ran 2 hours, 0 minutes, and 25, therefore I can run 2 minutes, 0 and 24. They can only race in the moment, and they've kind of plateaued. So I think technology is playing less of a role now than it maybe did in the past.
Interesting. Well, something you did notice with that runner, you mentioned the Kenyan marathon runner, Eliud Kipchoge, that when he runs, he smiles. Do you reckon smiling actually helps?
Yeah, well, I was skeptical at first. Everyone was talking about him smiling every few minutes during this 2 hour race, and I thought, that's not a smile, that's a grimace. Nobody could be smiling when they're running that fast. But afterwards, we asked him about it, and he said, yeah, he deliberately smiles in order to sort of convince himself that he's having fun and that the effort isn't as hard as he thought. And since then, there's actually been a very interesting study that found that when runners are told to smile, they end up burning about 2% less energy while running at the same pace. So there may be something to this idea that you can actually relax yourself on command in a way.
Wow. How much does being in a competition figure in being able to push out the limits of performance, Alex? Is the competitive aspect of it crucial?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a formal race, but there has to be something on the line, and it's very hard to voluntarily go into that sort of the depths of that cave where you really get everything out of yourself. I was talking recently to the guy who holds the heaviest deadlift on record from the 1983 World Strongest Man competition, and he said those heavy lifts, he learned ways of sending adrenaline through his body as part of his mental preparation, but it took a lot out of him, and he couldn't just do it on demand.
Right. And is that, I mean, is that why sports people can do better in competition? Like, you know, I think you make the point that athletes rarely set a personal best when they're in training.
Yeah, and even more than that, you know, not all competitions are created equal. So when we watch the Olympics over the next few weeks, as you said, we're going to see some performances that even the athletes themselves, even in other races, would never be able to do. There comes a sort of a very special alchemy when it just seems like that there's nothing more important on this earth than you know, going that little bit faster or going a little farther. And so that's not something you can replicate voluntarily or on demand.
And what about, does having an audience play a part in that as well, apart from it being a competitive situation? Do, you know, spectators at the Olympic Games or even on a more kind of everyday level, when you're working out with other people, say in a class with an instructor, does that make a difference?
Yeah, for sure. And I think everyone who's you know, run in a road race can understand the difference between what they can do in one of these big, you know, city to surf or a race like that compared to what they do on, you know, on any given Sunday. And there's really interesting research on the role of groups that you can actually get different changes in your brain chemicals if you do the same workout with your friends than doing it alone.
I think there was a study into a rowing team at Oxford that also found that working out together increased their pain threshold.
Yeah, absolutely. This was the Oxford rowing team, and then they tried doing identical workouts on a stationary rowing machine, either in a room by themselves or in a room with their friends, with their teammates, all doing still the same workout on rowing machines. And their pain tolerance, which is sort of a sign of things like adrenaline coursing through the body and endorphins, it increased far more even though the workout was the same. So there's something about being united by a common purpose with other people and doing things together, or sometimes even doing them in sync. So there's something about dancing, for example, that creates different brain chemicals, dancing with other people in sync compared to doing it by yourself.
This must tap quite deeply into our social nature as human beings, yeah?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, most of the researchers that I spoke to over the last 10 years researching this book were sports scientists, but this Oxford study was done by evolutionary anthropologists. They're interested in the origins of things like religion and communal movements, and they think that this is a really deeply wired behavior that makes us want to cooperate and move together and work towards common goals.
So it's a sort of deep evolutionary thing that's going on. Now, as you say, you've spent time talking to sports scientists who are looking at techniques to boost performance, to boost endurance. Can you give us maybe an example of one of the more curious or interesting of these tests that you came across?
Yeah, well, here's one that I wouldn't recommend. I tried electric brain stimulation, which involves basically running a current through a very weak current through your brain, which changes the excitability of the neurons, and it can change your perception of how hard a task is. And there's some pretty intriguing evidence that suggests that this can enhance your endurance. But I tried it. There's a Silicon Valley startup that makes a product that allows you to do this. And my scalp is I don't have any hair, so my scalp is apparently so rough that I couldn't make proper electrical contact. So I didn't succeed in breaking through my limits that way.
You also did a mental fatigue test, I think. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So if the brain endurance training is sort of the hope of instant changes, or the electrical stimulation is instant, brain endurance training is the process of basically fatiguing yourself mentally over and over, day after day, in the hopes that your brain gets more fatigue resistant, just in the same way that physically fatiguing yourself by running might make you more fatigue resistant. So I did computer tasks. Basically, you tap a button in response to flashing letters and numbers on the screen. And I was trying to do it for an hour a day for weeks. And there's some pretty interesting evidence funded by the British Ministry of Defense suggesting that this does enhance your physical endurance. But I have to say it was extremely boring and challenging. So you'd have to be pretty motivated to search for that last 0.5% before you decide to spend an hour a day playing the world's worst video game.
I think we'll leave that for the elite athletes. So, Alex, for us ordinary mortals, in between when we are watching people doing amazing things at these Winter Olympics, what's something that you can do mentally to stretch your limits and your endurance?
The thing that I came away with that if I had a time machine and could give some advice to my 20-year-old self, it would be to try motivational self-talk. And that's just the question of being aware of the monologue that's going on in your head when you're performing a task. Because we all have this monologue, whether we're aware of it or not. And if you stop and listen to it, you'll notice that sometimes you're saying, "Oh, this is too hard. I can't do this. Well, this feels terrible." And it sounds really sort of cheesy and ultra simple, but if you can learn and steadily practice recognizing those negative thoughts and replacing them with, "I'm ready for this, I can do this," there's actually been a series of studies in recent years showing that this can have an appreciable effect on your endurance, and it allows you to push harder. It allows you to push your physical, so they've done studies showing that you can push your core temperature higher, for example, by telling yourself, "I feel good," rather than "this is too hot."
I feel good. Okay. Alex Hutchinson is a former long-distance runner and physicist, and he's the author of a book called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance, joining us from a very chilly Toronto in Canada. Thanks, Alex. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks very much, Amanda. I enjoyed it.
This is Life Matters, and I'm Amanda Smith.